Rabbosai, begin the explanatory kinnas. We said a couple in shul. Some of you weren't in shul with us this morning. I'm not sure what was said in the different shuls, but I'll go over everything. We will, just by way of introduction, the very first kinna, we said it in shul already, starts on page 152. I noticed that there are actually different editions of the art school kinnas, so maybe off by a page or two. So double check as I'm going to announce the pages based on what I have written here, but in front of me. But there are different editions. I think they're off by a couple of pages, I guess, because of printing issues. So you can follow inside. And the first kinnah starts Shava Suri Meni Shimuni Orai, which we're not going to say again. People said it, but just by way of introduction, the word Shavas, you know, is what opens the kinnah because that's a word in the final parak of Eicha, and this kinna is taken from the psukim, from the words in the psukim at the end of the psukim at the end in the fifth parak of Megillas Eicha. The fifth parak is the one parak that does not follow the Aleph Beis order. It's a random order. However, it has 22 psukim, as there are letters in the Aleph Beis, as we mentioned. And I mentioned earlier this morning that this kinna, the first of the kinnas, begins with the letter Samach. Was unusual. You'd expect it to begin with letter Aleph, and actually it doesn't begin in the beginning of the Perek either. This the construct of this kina is that it has the letters, the arrangement is that it touches on each of the four Aleph-based chapters of Megillas Eicha. The first word in each stanza is the word from the fifth Perek, but the other words are the words from the corresponding number, the corresponding letter, in the other prakim of Megillas Eicha, the first parak, the second parak, and the fourth parak, and of course the third parak, as we know, has three lines to each letter, so all of them are incorporated into each of these lines. And some have suggested, as we mentioned, that the reason why this kinnah begins in the middle of the parak and the middle of the alphabet with the letter Samech is that it's a continuation of an earlier kinnah, an older kinnah, which was recited, or part of which was recited in the Shemoneh Esrei, in the Chazoras HaShatz, as a piyut for each one of the brachas, in the middle brachas of the Chazoras HaShatz. So, in other words, there are 13 brachas. There are 13 brachas in the middle part of the Chazoras HaShatz. So, each of those middle brachas had a little paragraph that preceded the Baruch Ato Hashem section, and Eicha, something about the related to this piyut, and therefore it picks up. Actually, there are 14. So the question is, which was the 14th of the brachas? Which one had of the earlier brachas had? But anyway, the samach continues. Samach is the 15th letter of the alphabet, and no more brachas in the Shemoneh Esrei. In the middle section of the Shemoneh Esrei, again, there's one extra, but it starts with the samach. It's a continuation of that kinnah. But I just want to focus for a moment on the word shavas, because it is the opening word of our morning kinnas. However it happened, the way we follow the kinnas, the word shavas is the opening word in our morning kinnas. And the word shavas means, as they translate out, everything came to a standstill. Sort of, if you will, an abrupt stop. I had the opportunity a few times in the last number of years, I was supposed to go this summer as well, obviously things didn't work out because of Corona, but I've had the opportunity the last number of summers and also during the school year to accompany some high school students to Poland. And of course, you go to Poland, you go to visit Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, there is one exhibit which was put together by Yad Vashem. Not all the tours necessarily go there. It was sponsored by Yad Vashem, but obviously the Jewish tours and certainly the religious Jewish tours go there. So when you walk into this particular exhibit inside one of what was, you know, barracks and so on during the Holocaust, you walk into this exhibit, what you see on the wall, it's a dark room, but you see on the wall films of different scenes from all kinds of different places in Europe. It says on the bottom, first there's a picture of a family at a picnic, and it says this is taking place in Holland. And the next, and they're all over the wall, you know, almost at the same time. This one is a picture of a family in Russia celebrating some kind of a family get-together. Another is a picture of a kid playing ball. Another is a picture of a person at work. And all these pictures kind of fill the wall and with, locations all over Europe, this town in Romania, and that town in Poland, and that town in Hungary, and that town in Czechoslovakia, and wherever else, and just normal, regular, everyday life scenes. That's what it is. In other words, it's nothing special. Yeah, there are some people, there are periods of shuls, and some people learning, but that's not what it's not. Not focusing on any particular thing other than normal, everyday activity. Families at the beach, and people getting in and out of a car, and all kinds of people at work, all kinds of different things. And then suddenly, the whole room goes black. And it just, to me anyway, it was a very, very powerful presentation, because what you saw there was everyday life and everyday people, normal families like us going through whatever it is that we're busy doing. And all of a sudden, the room goes dark, as if to say that whole world kind of abruptly and suddenly and permanently disappeared. And I think that there's something to say for that, because again, for these people and for the Jewish people, nothing was ever the same again after this abrupt stop. And so when we focus on the first of the kinnas, again, we said the kinnan shul. I'm not going to say it. Those who were not with us and would like to say it should certainly feel free to say it and to say anything. Even while I'm talking, I'm not going to be offended, especially since I can't tell. But even if I could, it's quite all right. But in any event, I think that word shavas is just, I thought of it. I thought at the time when I first saw that exhibit. And it struck me that that's what the artist, whoever it was that put that exhibit together, that part of the exhibit together, was trying to convey. That you had everyday normal life, normal people going about their normal business, and all of a sudden, sort of dramatically and abruptly, everything stopped. And I think that's what the word shavas kind of introduces over here as well. So I just wanted to reiterate that point. Again, I also mentioned that the samech, so according to our tradition, is important also. According to our tradition, the way we write, the Samech is a round letter. So it starts, Shavas Suru starts with the Samech stanza, kinnah number six. And the Samech is a round letter, has no beginning, no end. So I mentioned last night in Shul that the Samech actually, again, because it has no beginning and no end, can be seen to represent kind of like a circle that just doesn't stop and you never get anywhere. It's a frustration, so to speak. And perhaps one of the things we're supposed to feel, and that's also appropriate, I think, for the very first kinnah, for the beginning of the kinnahs, to feel a sense of frustration. I always feel that way on Tisha B'Av. We come to Tisha B'Av, and here we are again, about to recite kinnahs again. We did this already last year, and the year before, and the year before, and for the last many, many centuries. And unfortunately, we haven't made any progress, at least in terms of building the Beis HaMikdash. We're still here. We're still saying kinnah. So there's a certain sense of frustration. I mentioned the Samach is the one letter that doesn't appear in Chumash Bereishis with regard to the creation of the world, the Sheish Shemei Bereishis, if you look in Parashat Bereishis, because the world was created for us to progress, to move forward, to go weiter, so to speak, as we say in Yiddish. And when that doesn't happen, there's a sense of frustration. By the same token, though. We do, it's not complete frustration, because in fact, the mere fact that we are once again mourning the Churban means that in fact, we still remember it. And the language of the Gemara is, kolam yisabal Yerushalayim, whoever mourns Yerushalayim, it says, zocha v'roa b'nechama. It should say, in the grammar, we've pointed out this in the past, Yizkeh v'yireh, right? Kolam yisabal Yerushalayim, whoever mourns Yerushalayim, will. Yizkeh will merit, will see. But it says Zocheh v'ro in the present, not the future, but the present. Whoever mourns Yerushalayim sees or merits and sees the Nechama. And there's a many farshim explained, because we keep it alive. But the mere fact that we remember, the mere fact that we still say kinnas, the mere fact that we're still sitting on the floor and we're still mourning and so on and so forth, so it means we're already seeing the Nechama. There's a Nechama in keeping something alive. If we'd forgotten all about it, it would be gone forever. And there'd be no hope of return. But Zocheh v'roeh means we're experiencing that. So while we're frustrated, we're experiencing and keeping it alive. So while we're frustrated, nonetheless, there is some nechama in the fact that we're still observing the kinnahs today. We'll continue now with the seventh kinnah, Zion, in this list. Again, in my edition, it's 158. I mentioned before, maybe off by a page or two, if you're using the article kinnahs, there are two different, or at least two different editions. So maybe a few pages off. I apologize. But this kinnah begins, each stands with the word Eicha. It's interesting because the word Eicha is basically almost, if you will, a challenge to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eicha, how could you do that? How could this happen? And it's almost could argue it's a bit offensive. You know, what gives us a right? We're questioning HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides. So what do you mean we're questioning? We're challenging HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Eicha, how could such a thing happen? I mean, how could such a thing happen? HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed, and this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, and that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has set up. So what with the question of Eicha, we ordinarily would not be allowed to ask such a question, except that Yirmiyahu Navi asked the question. Okay, it's in Kisra HaKodesh, Megillas Eicha, written by Yirmiyahu. He asked. He was the mater, so to speak. He gave us a license to say, Eicha, we can ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could you do such a thing? Again, ordinarily it would be considered a bit of a chutzpah, but since Yirmiyahu kind of opened the door, we asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could it happen? So to speak, we're telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, we're following the path as were of Yirmiyahu. But this kind of really describes that, you know, in the strongest possible way, because it says, that's the second stanza. Right? Each stanza in this kinnah begins with the word Eicha, and how could you do this? Velo zacharta, you seem to have forgotten all about whatever it is all about. Here it's Velo zacharta, bris ben absarim, okay? Or in other statements later on, Velo zacharta in the fourth stanza, chitun chukei chorev, asher chakakta l'chamulecha. Chitun chukei chorev means the chasana, so to speak, the wedding, as it were, of the Jewish people on HaKadosh Baruch Hu at Har Sinai. Chorev is another name for Har Sinai, or the principal name, actually, for Har Sinai. So each one of these stanzas begins with the question of Eicha, and it's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has forgotten. And therefore we say, and each stanza ends with, we say, Zechor Hashem Mehayolanu, which is the opening phrase of the last parak of Megillas Eicha. After we've asked Eicha, you know, actually four times, as it were, or Parakim Aleph Beis and Dalet, Gimel doesn't start with Eicha. Finally, we say, Zechor Hashem Mehayolanu, please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, remember. In other words, it's a contrast between Velo Zacharta and Zechor. Zechor Hashem Mehayolanu. Velo Zacharta doesn't mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself forgot about it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't forget anything, obviously. But Zechor means to bring it to our active memory. With human beings as well, we have a passive memory. So I'll say something right now, which you weren't thinking about a minute ago, but once I say it, you'll think about it, right? Okay, your mother's maiden name. So you know it. It's in the back of your head. You know your mother's maiden name, but you weren't thinking about it until I just mentioned it now. It doesn't mean you forgot about it. You didn't forget it. Okay, you knew it before. You knew it then as well. But it wasn't part of your active memory. That's the way memory works. Sometimes we active memory remember things. And other times we have things in the back of our head. It doesn't mean we forgot it. It doesn't mean we're not thinking about it. So we say over here, Velo Zacharta, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you didn't remember. Not that he forgot. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't forget anything. But it's not, so to speak, in human language, it's not his active memory. So therefore we say, Zechor Hashem Eilonu, bring it in, so to speak, to your active memory. So we'll pause now to recite this Kinnah, Kinnah Zayin, Eicha Atzo B'Apecha. The next kinnah number Ches, Ader Chuk Shamayim, let my lament, let my mourning soar to the heavens, unusual word, Ader Chuk Shamayim. Basically, the two things that are being suggested here. One is that we want, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to join us in our mourning and in our sorrow. We have this concept of Ima Anochi B'Tzara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that he too participates in our tzar. Okay, so that's one thing that our mourning and our bad feelings, so to speak, should soar to the heavens. But also, there's something else that Soloveitchik pointed out, that the Churban HaBayis was not only a historical event that was disastrous and catastrophic for the Jewish people, in a certain sense, it was what he called a cosmic catastrophe. It was change in the whole world. If we believe that the Beis HaMikdash was the center in terms of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as Shlomo HaMelech says when he describes the building of the Beis HaMikdash, the first way he davens, and he says it's tefillah, after building the first Beis HaMikdash, that all tefillahs from wherever travel through here, and that's what we believe in the Kabbalistic sense and others and so on. So basically, there's been a change in the cosmos, so to speak, of Soloveitchik said, that when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, it's as if the whole universe functions in a different way. There is a phrase, Or Yom Machrivi Pa'amayim, twice. We know that the Beis HaMikdash, both the first and the second, were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, obviously. And There were other, of course, many tragic days. And the idea of this cosmic tragedy is that there was something almost about the day itself. If you look at the Rambam, the third perek of Hilchos Tainis and Halacha Hey, when the Rambam describes Tisha B'Av and mentions the five things that took place on Tisha B'Av, we mentioned earlier in Shul, but I'll go over it again. The five things that they mentioned, the five things which the Mishnah says happened on Tisha B'Av. Number one, the decision that the generation of the Dor HaMidbar would not go into Eretz Yisrael, would rather die out in the desert. That event in the aftermath of the report of the Meraglim, that happened on Tisha B'Av. The Gemara has a whole calculation to demonstrate that. Doesn't say in the Chumash that it happened on the 9th of Av, but the Gemara has a whole calculation based on dates that are reported in the Chumash. So that we figure out, we knew how long the Meraglim, they were in Eretz Yisrael for 40 days, and so on, a whole cheshbon. If you're interested, you can look it up in the Gemara Tainis Daf Chav Tes and Aleph, has a whole calculation how we get to Tisha B'Av, but that happened on Tisha B'Av. The Churban Bayis Rishon was on Tisha B'Av, the Churban Bayis Sheni was on Tisha B'Av. The destruction of the city of Beitar and the loss of tens of thousands of Jewish lives, as part of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, that too took place on Tisha B'Av, and then the city was overturned, plowed over. That was on Tisha B'Av. But the Rambam, when he presents it, you look in the Rambam Perek Hay of Hilchos Tainis Halacha Gimel. The Rambam's expression is Uvi Yom's. I don't have it in front of me, but more or less Uvi Yom Ze Hamuchan LePeronios. This day was set aside for Peronios, so to speak. It's like the very day itself. There's something about the day itself, okay? And our Soloveitchik elaborated on this by pointing out that we have, within our system of time, and our system of measuring time and marking time and so on, time has certain attributes, so to speak. There was such a concept called the Yom Tov. In its literal definition, Yom Tov means a good day. That's all it means. We wish other a good Yom Tov. A good Yom Tov is a double language, and it's a good Yom Tov, good day. You know, what is good Yom Tov? You know, Yom Tov itself means, but Yom Tov takes on a characteristic itself. It's defined in the day. And of course, we have the concept of Kedushas Hayom, right? That a day itself has sanctity. The day of Shabbos itself has sanctity. Something about the day itself. Physically, scientifically, leaving out what the Gemara says that the certain river, the Sambatyon River, didn't rage on Shabbos as it did on the as it did on the weekdays, but leaving that out, in terms of the observable world, there's nothing different about Shabbos than about any other day. You look outside, you know, the sun shines or it doesn't, it rains, whatever. There's nothing noticeably different about the world on Shabbos as opposed to any other day. Again, leaving out that medrash about the Sambatyon, but but yet the day has kedusha. There's a concept of kedusha hayom. Or we find that Yom Kippur, the Itzumo Shayom is Mechaper, the day itself, somehow, however we understand it, the day itself grants atonement. So in our system, the Rav pointed out, there's a day itself, there's a Yom Chol, there's a Yom Kodesh, a day itself can be distinguished from another day. And Tisha B'Av is a day, as the Rambam puts it in Hilchos Tainis, I don't think the Rav necessarily quoted this Rambam, but it fits in very well. It says it's a Yom HaMuchan LePeronos. It's a day of, that's set aside for mourning and for sadness. And again, as I've said before, we've all seen lists of different things that happened historically on Tisha B'Av throughout the millennia, not just the five things that the Mishnah mentions, but subsequently that down to modern times. You know, the declaration of World War I on Tisha B'Av. Many, many things happen on Tisha B'Av. This is a day, there's something about the day itself, which is set aside for Peronios. So we observe the 9 days, in advance of Tisha B'Av, or leading up to Tisha B'Av, including Tisha B'Av, the so-called 9 days. Some midrashim say that even the animals are impacted. There's something about it, something in the air, which we can't perceive in the observable universe, but that's part of this idea that when we say Ader Chuk Shamayim, we sort of, we soar up, so to speak, to the heavens as if we want the heavens themselves to cry along with us. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, and later on in the standard it says, in the Gimel it says, Agora eti kol b'nei bayis. Okay? Kol b'nei bayis. B'nei bayis can mean a person, a member of one's household. And there's perhaps an interesting, again, noting the day, point to ponder about Tisha B'Av, and we do it, we have raised observant children and so on, that just as the idea on Yontif is that the entire household is supposed to be happy. Look at the Rambam, Hilchos Yontif, the Rav pointed out. The Rambam speaks that it's incumbent upon the people running the household to make sure that everyone in the household is happy on Yontif. The mitzvah Simchas Yontif is not just for me, and however we define Simchas Yontif, eating meat, drinking wine, whatever, we're not going to go through the halachas now on Tisha B'Av, but however we define Simchas Yontif, it's not just for myself, but I'm obligated to make sure that the members of my household have simcha as well. The Gemara says that a husband should buy nice clothes or jewelry for his wife, and should give the kids sweets and treats and so on and so forth to encourage Simchas Yontif. And of course, specifically, let's say Pesach. On Pesach night, there's a mitzvah. You got it to Levincha. You have to tell it to the children. So the Rav suggests that the same may well be true of Tisha B'Av. Okay, that there's some sort of an inyan on Tisha B'Av to not Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, but Sipur Churban Yerushalayim, to make the children aware of what happened. And even though, excuse me, when it comes to Avelus, we have a din in Chinuch L'Avelus, that we don't, a child, strictly speaking, under the age of Bar Bas Mitzvah, so again, Rachman Tzav, the parent dies, the child's not obligated to sit Shiva. Okay, but here, there is this type of Chinuch here for this global tragedy. Finally, one point, one other thing, in the I'm going to find it now. In the Mem stanza, it says, the Dalit stanza. Ad ve'becholev lehamtzi ehu. Okay? Lehamtzi ehu. Lehamtzi ehu. To be found, so to speak. What is Lahamtzi Ehu? Okay, with the Adbe B'chol Lev Lahamtzi Ehu, I will seek him. So that's a reference perhaps to what we learned in the Torah this morning. Pasuk says, V'kashta Mishamas Hashem Lekecha Umot Sasa. If you search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you will find him. That, of course, is talking about tshuva, which we've discussed many times in past years. It's an important theme of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is sort of a fusion of two themes, Avelus and Teshuvah. Both are parts of Tisha B'Av. So that's the idea here. Ad b'cholev lahamtzieu. Okay, I want to be found. I will seek out our Kodesh Baruch Hu, v'kashtu misham. Or like we say a lot of times in the Slichas, when introducing that pasuk, we say, he motzei lanu b'vakashosenu. Okay, make yourself found, so to speak. Part of Churban, part of destruction is Hester Panim, our Kodesh Baruch Hu hiding. And so we appeal to our Kodesh Baruch Hu, so to speak, to reveal himself. Okay, and to help us find him, so to speak. That's also part of the kinnah and part of the process of tshuva. At the very end of the kinnah, it says Yisrael me'ez bedrocha lo halachu. This is a sort of poignant end, because the truth is we ask Eicha, how could a Kadosh Baruch Hu do this? How could this happen? And so on. But Kadosh Baruch Hu said, well, it's not that you people are so innocent. The Haftarah that we laid on Tisha B'Av, the Haftarah for this morning, the Haftarah asked, Amah of the Aretz, based on what, for what reason was the land destroyed? Okay, Amah of the Aretz. And then it says, Allah Zohar Tarasi, you've abandoned my Torah. So I have to keep that theme in mind. Again, that connects to the concept of the Tshuva. And we'll say this, Kinah now, Kinah Ches, Adel Chuk Shamayim. The next kinnah test, Echa Tifarti Marashosai Hishlichu. That's a phrase which is based on the pasuk in the Hishlich fourth parak, I think, of Megillah. It says, Hishlich Mishmaim Eretz Tifaris Yisrael, Tifarti is my glory, my crown. And we say again, Echa, how could such a thing possibly happen? Kina here is modeled after, again, Psukim, of course, from Eicha and the whole Aleph Beis. But what's unique or it's introduced here in this Kina is the phrase or a phrase ending each stanza from the Tochacha, but not the bad part of the Tochacha, but so to speak, the introduction to Tochacha in the beginning of Parshas B'chukosai. So you look at the first stanza, Eicha Tifarti Marashosai Shlichu, it says, Im B'chukosai Telechu. That ends the stanza. Next stanza ends The next one, we see Glachem Daesh as Potsi. These are all psukim. These are psukim of bracha. These are psukim saying that we were told that if we observe all the mitzvahs, we'll deserve or receive the brachas of our Kadosh Baruch Hu. However, sort of a find it exactly in the Lamed stanza. It continues, unfortunately, to turn the brachas turn into klolos. In each case of the where the bracha psukim are mentioned, it says we get the opposite, right? We're not zocha. We don't get, or we don't we get the opposite of what it says. But as the psukim continue in the lamed stanza, we lo sishmu, and the mem stanza, of course, I timoso, and so on. Those are the psukim which introduce the tocha itself, which carries us through to the end of the kina, and that did come true. In other words, the kina is saying that unfortunately the brachas were suspended. And all these things were suspended, but the other things came true. It's interesting also describing the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. So it says in the Ches stanza, beginning with the word Choshav. So it says Kitor Chupas Aholo Kakivshon. The smoke went up like the smoke from an oven, right? The smoke goes up like from a burning furnace. Okay. Now the reference, of course, to the Beis Hamikdash, the smoke from the Beis Hamikdash ascended like the smoke from a furnace. But it's interesting; it calls to mind anyway the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, where the pasuk says that the same comparison. It says that the smoke went up from the, after Sodom and Amorah overturned to look like Kitorah Kivshon, like the smoke from a from a furnace. And that's the idea that the Navi spoke about Yeshaya that we learned in the Haftorah of Shabbos Chazon. He said, Kisdom hayinu l'amara demino. We were compared, we were similar. We suffered the fate, so to speak, of Sodom and Amora. We were as wicked as they are, and we suffered the same fate as they are. And that's what's hinted at, perhaps, in the stanza by mentioning Hola Kakivshon, okay, that with the smoke went up like that from a furnace. Towards the end of the kina, so I'll find it in a moment. Yeah, basically the tough stanza, the very final stanza, says Tikra Eid Olalta Admoni. Basically, asking Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Admoni referred to Rome, Edom, asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to please turn the table, so to speak, and take revenge on our enemies. Okay, and when we've undergone all the suffering for so long, and enemies have gotten away with it, we say to our Kodesh Baruch Hu, let them be punished as well, let our enemies be punished as well, that we shouldn't fear them anymore. It's interesting that we have a minig on Pesach night to open the door, right? Shrocha Moschel Agoyim, right? Towards the end of the Seder by Hallel. So we say, Shrocha Moschel Agoyim, Ashalei Deucha. We cast our Kodesh Baruch Hu to pour out his wrath on our enemies. And the minig of opening the door, so there's an idea of Eliyahu. Navi coming to the house, whatever that represents, when we're little kids. So we open the door for Eliyahu, so to speak. And it's not just little kids. It's the idea that somehow Eliyahu visits every home. I'm not saying he drinks the wine, but whatever. But Eliyahu Navi comes in. But there's also this notion that it's a lil shimurim, that it's a protected, a safe night. So we're not afraid of our enemies. And Adarabba, we call out. And actually, in that little paragraph, Shor Chamos Chan Hagoda, is a pasuk from Megillas Eicha, Tirdof Bafis Hashmidei Mitachas Shmei Hashem, is a pasuk that ends the paragraph, Shor Chamos Chan Seder. We call out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to, again, take a revenge on our enemies who are deserving of punishment. So that's how this kina ends as well. Continue now with the kina ches. Eicha Tifar Timrash Osai Yishlichu. Next kina, can you go to Eicha Yashra Chavetzelos Hashoron? This kina actually is a description, again, taking words from the first paragraph of Megillas Eicha, and it mourns the loss of the 24 families of Kahuna, the Mishmaros HaKahuna. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Tainis that there were, by a certain point in the history of Klal Yisrael, So you didn't need to have so many kohanim on a daily basis in the Beis Hamikdash. How much activity was there, right? They didn't need so many kohanim. More and more families and so on. So you had more and more kohanim. So in the days of the Nevi'im already, the time of David HaMelech, Shmuel Hanavi, the Gemara says, divided the Kahuna families into 24 families, 24 units, the Chof Dal of Mishmaros, and there was a rotational basis that each family of Kohanim came to the Beis HaMikdash for 1 week out of the year. Well, for 1 week, then there were 23 other groups, and then they came back a second time. So basically twice a year, okay? And the Psukim and Divrei HaYomim, Divrei Aleph, enumerate all the different Mishmaros and different families and so on. So this Kina describes them. In fact, some version of the Kina, in the Rosenfeld's edition of the Kina, after each stanza, it says what the name of the corresponding family was about. It tells us that the Kohanim, of course, in a certain sense, lost even more than everybody else did in the Churban, because it was particularly difficult for them because they had no role anymore that was unique as it had been before. Besides that, however, suggested, we mentioned in the past, that the Kohanim were the ones who fought very, shall we say, valiantly. We know, we've all been to Yerushalayim, so you know, you go through in any of the entrances, let's say Shar Yafo or Shar Tzion, and you enter into the city, to get from there to the Kotel HaMaravi takes about 15 minutes, okay? They broke through the city on Shavuos V'Tamuz. It took them 3 weeks to get to the Beis HaMikdash. You know, I mean, 3 weeks? It's not that far a trip. You know, to the whole old city is, about a square mile, I think. Okay, it's not exactly a large area. So it took them a very long time. And that's because the people fought very valiantly to prevent them from to getting through. So there's a tribute, so to speak, to the Kohanim. Okay. More than that, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, the Romans destroyed, they went after the Kohanim specifically, okay, and, you know, the Romans persecuted the Kohanim, and more than anybody else, because they recognized the Kohanim were the intellectuals, very often the teachers. We know, we just said that the Kohanim worked in the Beis HaMikdash only two weeks out of the year. What did the whole rest of the year? Okay, well, what did the Kohanim do? They didn't have their own field and so on. Levi had no chelik in Eretz Yisrael. So what did the Kohanim do all year long? 2 weeks out of the year, your family was on duty in the Beis HaMikdash. And by the Shalosh Regalim, your family was on duty in the Beis HaMikdash. What did you do the whole rest of the year? So we know the Kohanim were the teachers. They were the educators. Kisisa Kohanim Yishma Da'as V'Tari of Akshem Epiya, the Pasuk says. That's an Haftar of Emor. So basically, the Kohanim, the Levim, were the teachers of Klal Yisrael. The Romans understood that the future of the Jewish people in terms of the Torah was in that sense in the hands of the Kohanim, and that's why they were persecuted and killed out. So those two things allow us to, again, the fact that they were, or three things really, the fact that in a certain sense the Kohanim lost even more with the Beis HaMikdash than anybody else, the fact that the Kohanim fought so valiantly to delay at least the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, or delay the conquest of Yerushalayim to the extent that they could. And the idea that, they went after the Kohanim as a teacher of Klal Yisrael, for all these reasons, the Rav Elazar Kalir perhaps composed a piyut, a kina, sort of mourning the losses experienced by the families of the Kohanim, and destruction of their particular cities that they had. So that's what this kin is about. Eicha Yoshua Chavatzela Sasharon, kin number 10. Next kin Yud Aleph, Vayikonin Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu HaMelech was one of the great tzaddikim of the Malchei Beis David. He was one of the outstanding kings who inspired a big tshuva movement and so on. There were really no one like him other than David HaMelech himself, except that he made a mistake. To describe during this kina, Paro Necho, the Egyptian leader, wanted to march through Eretz Yisrael, not to start up necessarily with the Jews, but he wanted to march his armies through Eretz Yisrael in order to wage war someplace else, and wage war in a different location. But Yoshiyahu assumed that because the Jewish people were righteous in his time, and he had inspired, as I said, a whole movement to Tshuva, he felt that... it says in the Pasuk, V'cherev lo savor ba'artzachem, no sword will go through your land. And usually it's interpreted to mean, to come, no sword, no army will come to fight with you. But if you're really deserving, it won't even pass through your land. No army will pass through your land on the way somewhere else. And Yoshio felt that we'd come to that point, as it's that idea is quoted, Osabar Cherub Kosho Ephraim. But the Navi Yirmiyahu told him, no, we're not really at that level yet. We're not fully deserving of that. And Yirmiyahu advised him to let Paro Necho and his army come through. Yoshio didn't do so. And it was a battle that took place in Megiddo. It's all described in the Divrei Yomim. And Yoshio himself was killed in that battle. And Yirmiyahu wrote a kina in memory of Yoshio. There's a pasuk in Divrei Yomim Beis, Perek Lamed Hei, which describes the whole battle at Megiddo and the death of Yoshio. And there it says that Yirmiyahu wrote and his eulogy, his hesped, his eulogy for Yoshio was written in a book in some sort of a book of kinos. It doesn't say where. However, Chazal tell us that that's the fourth parak of Megillas Eicha, is actually about the death of Yoshiyahu. Now, Yoshiyahu was a wonderful person, okay, no question, one of the great tzaddikim. And so we wonder, however, why a specific kina was devoted to him in our kinas this morning. We're not mourning individual people, are we? Well, yes, because first of all, Chazal tell us, Shkula Misasan Shot Tzaddikim Kesefes Beis Elokeinu. The Gemara brings that up in connection with why we have a fast for Gedaliah, Tzom Gedaliah, of the Tzaddik. So the destruction of a Tzaddik, the death of a Tzaddik is like the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But more than that, perhaps, who knows what it would have been if Yoshio would have remained alive. Perhaps he could have averted the whole Churban altogether. Perhaps he could have continued to motivate people to do tshuva. And again, he was successful to a great extent, but the success wasn't complete. But had that tshuva movement, so to speak, we refer to it today as a tshuva movement, had that tshuva movement continued, perhaps, who knows, the Beis HaMikdash destruction could have been averted altogether. So that's why we speak about, or we mourn, the death of Yoshiyahu. And we have a kina specifically devoted to him, kina Yud Aleph. We'll continue with that. Next, kina, kina Yud Beis, Oli Asher Toavta Adlo Bereshis. Oh, every stanza here begins with the word Ohel. Ohel means, in our sense, a tent. In modern Hebrew, it means a tent. But it refers to the Mishkan, or even the Beis HaMikdash itself. It's a tent. It's a place where Kadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself. The opening stanza describes it as Ol Asher Ta'avta Adlo Bereshis. You, Kadosh Baruch Hu, desired this even before Bereshis, even before the creation of the world. The Gemara tells us there were six or perhaps seven things six things besides the Beis HaMikdash, which were created or at least conceived of before the creation of the world: Torah, Tshuva, Gan Eden, Gehenim, Kisei HaKavod, the Beis HaMikdash, and also the name of the Mashiach. Okay, in other words, the Beis HaMikdash already existed in a certain sense. In a certain sense, the Beis HaMikdash already existed before the world was created. It was part of the blueprint, so to speak, of the world. The Beis HaMikdash, it was, the first Beis HaMikdash, in a certain sense, was not the first Beis HaMikdash. It was not even the Mishkan. As Soloveitchik pointed out, the whole world, so to speak, was the Beis HaMikdash, so to speak, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwelled in. And the Rav suggests, if not for the Chait of Adam HaRishon and so on, so you wouldn't have needed a specific place for Kedusha. Kedusha would have been infused or accessible or perceptible everywhere, okay, in the universe, in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. The whole world, so to speak, had the Kedusha sort of the Beis HaMikdash. However, that was lost as a result of the Chait in Gan Eden or Adam HaRishon, and that Kedusha went away. It reappeared in the Mishkan on a temporary basis, and ultimately more permanently in the place of the Beis HaMikdash. But in a certain sense, what we see from here, the Rav stressed, is that the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash is not limited to a particular place. Anywhere, every place where a Jew studies Torah, every place where a Jew observes mitzvahs and so on, in a certain sense, takes on the creation of the status of the Beis HaMikdash, because we see that it existed even before the world was created. It existed, the whole world, anywhere on earth, has potential for the existence of the Beis HaMikdash, to be a presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. So in that sense, the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash is not finite. It's a different dimension. Okay, the whole world, like we say in the davening, Melo Chol Aretz Kvodo, right? Melo Chol Aretz Kvodo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in Kabbalistic terms, had to be mitzamtzem himself. And it's really the Medrash like that before the Kabbalah. But I mean, Kadosh Baruch Hu had to limit himself, so to speak, to bring his kedusha down to the Beis Hamikdash. But really, it's present everywhere, and there are references in this skina to other tents. So, for example, Ola shekomamta la'esonei kedem. Okay, the Esonim Avram Avinu, Eson is Rachi, Avram Avinu, and had a tent. We know that Avram's tent was known for Hachnosis Orchem and so on. So the Shechina dwelled in that tent as well. We know that when Yitzchak married Rivka, so certain miracles which had existed in the tent of the mother Sarah returned with Rivka. So every tent that the Avos had, Yaakov Avinu is known as Yoshev Ohalim, right? The Oil of Shame, the Oil of Aver. There are many different references to different tents long before the Beis HaMikdash per se was built, and therefore we can say the same thing. Long after the Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed, there was still a place for Kedusha in this world. That's perhaps one of the ideas of this Kinnah. Ultimately, however, the Kinnah is a negative. The Kinnah keeps asking, questions at the end of each stanza. How could this happen? And so on. The Beis HaMikdash still, at the end of the day, was the place where the Shechina was most perceptible. And even though we can recreate it, we have the concept of Mikdash Ma'at, the Mikdash Ma'at meaning a miniature version of the Beis HaMikdash, based on the Pasuk Yecheskel, the Gemara, and the end of Megillah. But nonetheless, we don't have the same thing. It's not quite the same as in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's what this Shechina mourns. And each stanza, so to speak, ends with a question, which basically says, how in the world could this have happened, or the exclamation that we have to mourn what happened to the ultimate tent, the great tent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Beis HaMikdash, Kinah Yud Beis, all the Yashrei Tov. The next Kinah 13, as a play on the word Echa, and divides into two words, from Echa to Eko, and has a reference to numerous brachas. You can, as you read through the Kinah, you'll see yourself, numerous brachas are introduced with the word ko throughout the Torah. So, for example, you'll see by Avraham Avinu it says ko ye zaracha. By Yitzhak, the next stanza it also says by the Akedah Nivanar Nelchad ko. By Yaakov ko yomar. By Moshe Rabbeinu it says vayifin ko vacho. Numerous, not only brachas but descriptions or references to people, to great heroes who either represented or have functioned with regard to the word ko in a special way. And certainly the brachas of Brichas Kohanim, ko sevarchus b'nei Yisrael, and many things that are referenced in a positive sense to ko. So we ask, a ko, where is the ko? What happened to this? All this seems to have disappeared. Okay, all of our glory and the ko. All right, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out there's a difference between ko and po, right? We'll see that also. But by the Akedah, it said, Shulachem po imachamor. Okay, Vanir Vana, Nelchad ko. Ko is beyond. Ko is the ability to see more. Ko is the ability to project down the road. Po is to be concerned only in what's here in front of us. Ko. And that was the greatness of Avram Yitzchak, Yach Moshe, and they saw well beyond and conducted themselves accordingly. And now, when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, we ask, hey, Ko, what happened to that? What happened to that vision of glory? What happened to that ability to see beyond? And I think it's poignant today also. Sometimes people only see what's immediately in front of them. They only, what's happening right now? They don't look down the road at the ramifications of what they're doing and what they're saying and so on. That takes a talent. Many people have only the Po approach. Right, the Shulachem Po Imachamor. That was certain people. Avram left his servants. Shulachem Po, your people who represent Po, you only see what's right here in front of you, and so you stay here. But me, Avaniva Naran El Chor Ko, I and my son Yitzchak will go beyond. And so that's what the word Ko represents. And of course, many Nevuahs open the word Ko Amar Hashem. Right, it's projecting beyond. It's seeing beyond what's in front of you. But on Tisha, we mourn, Ko, what happened to all those glorious visions relating to the future? And we're stuck, we're mired in a presence, going back to what I said at the very beginning, that Samech, they're going in circles, being back at Tisha B'Av yet again, we're stuck in the Po, but we really need to look for the Ko. Kinah 13, Ko.
I think you're muted.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. This Kina 14, speaks about the idea of the Churban being known to the Avos in advance. Yaakov Avinu wanted to tell his children when the Geula would ultimately be, at the beginning of Parshas Vayechi, towards the beginning of Parshas Vayechi, but then the Shekhinah departed. Moshe Rabbeinu and Parshas Zos HaBrocha, the same thing. These things are hinted at over here. Towards the end of the Kina, it describes a beautiful phrase, a powerful phrase, Ru'u ma'avera osa. Look at what a sin can bring about. And that's talking about the destruction not only of the Beis Hamikdash per se, but specifically there about the Churban of Gilgal, you know, the Mishkan, when they had the Mishkan in Eretz Yisrael, in the Midbar, they came into Eretz Yisrael, so the Mishkan rested in different places, and ultimately those places lost their Kedusha, but the Beis Hamikdash and Mishalayim was considered permanent. The Kedusha remained forever. But in places like Gilgal and Shiloh, where they had the Mishkan temporarily, those places did not survive as places of Kedusha. But again, all of this is brought out, the destruction is brought about because of Avera, as it says at the end of the Kina, look what Avera can do. And again, that ties in with the notion of Tshuva as being a theme of Tisha B'Av as well. We'll say Kina Yudalad, Kina Tesvav, we said in Shul, the long Kina, which has an intricate presentation, you can say it to yourselves, we said it in Shul already. So after we finish this Kina, number 14, Yudalad will continue with number 16 on page 226. So we'll continue to say now, Yudalad Echa Eis Asher Kfar Asu. Continue now with Kina number 16, Tes Zion, which is on page 226 in the article edition, Zechora She'osa Tzar Bifinim, which tells the story of Titus, the Roman general who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. The siege was begun by Vespasian, but was not carried out. The destruction of Beis HaMikdash was not carried out by Vespasian, as he was called back to become the emperor. And Titus took over, and he's the one who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But he didn't just destroy the Beis HaMikdash, but we know from Chazal that the Romans committed various atrocities, right? The general Titus, the Gemara tells in Gittin, it's among the Gemaras you're allowed to study on Tisha B'Av, that Titus came into the Beis HaMikdash with a declaration or an announcement that he had defeated the God of the Jews, okay? And he was the one who was able to conquer the Beis HaMikdash, and he, so to speak, defeated God himself. And showed, we know that the Romans are very proud of this. We know from the Arch of Titus, the carving of the picture of the menorah and so on being led into Golas. But Titus did more than that. He didn't just destroy, but he actually cursed HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara tells us that he dragged a prostitute into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and took a Sefer Torah, unrolled the scroll of the Sefer Torah, etc., and had his way with her on top of that Sefer Torah in the Holy of Holies and so on. And it was just an idea to obliterate and defeat not only the Jewish people as a nation, but the Jewish religion. And very often, even though people say that, well, they've got nothing against the Jewish religion, it's a certain people, it's only Israel or whatever it is that we say today in politics, it's not most of the time untrue. Most of the time, those people who are actual enemies have things against us as a nation, not only as a people, but as a nation, not only as a people, our nation, but as a religion. They don't like our religion. So it's couched in other terms, okay? But people who dislike Jews very often dislike our religious behavior deep down. It's not just, well, you know, the state of Israel does this and does that. That's very often a smokescreen. And the best proof of that is that these very same people complain about, you know, Israel and the Palestinians and so on, do not complain at all about other countries who treat certain populations in their land the exact same way. You don't hear a word about it, not a word. These very same people don't demand what they do. They claim to be speaking about human rights and so on and so forth and social justice, and it's most of the time it's good old-fashioned anti-Semitism. Again, the best proof being that these very same people very often, I'm not saying all, but many of these people say nothing about mistreatment of minorities in other places, you know, far worse than anything that the government of Israel does. So it's the same thing here. Titus destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, but it was much more than simply destroying the Jewish nation. He wanted to show that that the Jewish religion, you know, has been defeated. And the Romans, truthfully, were successful at that. The Romans had done that in other areas they conquered as well. The Romans did destroy not only the countries and conquered, but they, shall we say, Romanized the lands that they conquered, okay? And Latin became the spoken language, and their religion eventually was Christianity, spread, right? It was not just the conquering in a political sense. And the Jews stubbornly refused, even after, you know, I mean, let's be honest. You know, when the Jews revolted, and the Rav Soloveitchik pointed this out, when the Jews revolted in the Bar Kokhba rebellion 50 to 60 years after the Churban, it was over already. So what were they fighting back for? They want to build another temple? It's gone already. The Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed. So they should have forgotten all about it, but they didn't. They didn't. The Jewish people remember. And that's the idea. This whole, this whole parak begins with the words. Each stanza begins with the words from the fifth and last chapter of Megillas Eicha, Zechor Hashem Mehalom, Zechor, remember, right? We remember. And that's why I said at the beginning of the presentation this morning that the fact that we do remember shows that we keep it alive. The Jewish people have always kept, even though in a certain sense we're moving in circles, like I said last night, we're back on Tisha B'Av, and you know, a year later, and then there's no Beis HaMikdash still, and so on and so forth. With all that, we remember and we keep the Beis HaMikdash an active memory. It's alive. And by doing that, you know, we've defeated the Romans, because the fact is we continue to remember it. Our culture wasn't destroyed. And, you know, this kina, basically, you know, we asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu to remember this terrible thing that was done. But towards the end of the kina, we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kol zos ba'asno velo shechachnuo. Shechachnucha. We haven't forgotten you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu not to forget us either. Continue with this Kina Tezayin Zachor. The next Kina Yedzayin Alalai Li is the ending phrase of each stanza, woe unto me, or alas unto me. And the truth of the matter is, every single stanza would describe some of the horrors on the personal level that took place when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. We have to bear in mind, this kind of reminds us, the personal suffering, the individual suffering. We tend to focus, understandably so, on the Churban HaBayis and then the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, the loss of the Avod, and everything that the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash represents. However, we sometimes tend to forget that it was great personal loss. It was great personal suffering. Human beings, our ancestors, right, suffered terribly. And it's, again, the Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that none of the things that are mentioned here were the result of a poetic license or some creativity by the author, Elazar Kalir. Every one of these things is either a pasuk in Megillah or elsewhere in Nach, or it's from a medrash. You know, and you just read through it, you see the English itself just terrible. Tochalna Nashim Piryam, women, eat their children and so on and so forth. It's unimaginable, things that are unimaginable. Alayli, woe unto us. You know, this afternoon, this is a preview, this afternoon, I plan to speak with Hashem about the so-called Black Death, the great global pandemics before Corona. And there we find written records, we'll see, of parents simply abandoning their children because of the fear of death and so on. That was such a horrible thing. You can't even imagine it, but it happened then. It happened in the time of the Churban as well. And if you look through each one of these stanzas, I urge you to look at in English and see. You understand why he ends each stanza with Alalai Li, you know, woe unto me, alas unto me, that these things happen. Again, none of these are fictional. None of these are imaginary. They're all part of the experience that the Jewish people as individuals had at the time of the siege and the time of the destruction of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. The next kin about Tamarta, kin Yud Ches. Tamarta, again, is a contrast, like we had the kin before of Eko. This kin contrasts the Haftocha. You told us this and so on, and you did this for us, and therefore now, so why has this tragedy or that tragedy befallen us? There's a contrast between what HaKadosh Baruch Hu initially, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did and said, and so on, so why did you allow this? And then it turns, and every stanza has Atah and Veloma, all the terrible things that you allowed to happen. Why have you allowed this to happen? Again, that question of, of Echa. But the idea is that there is such a concept of Zuchus Avos, right? Zuchus Avos, the merit of our ancestors. But the Gemara says at a certain point, Zuchus Avos Tama. Eventually, Zuchus Avos runs out, right? There's a limit to how many times you can call on the merit of somebody else. You know, sometimes I can have somebody who... do me a favor because you like my father, you like my mother, whatever. After a while, the person stops doing me a favor. You go to court, the judge finds out that you're the son of his good friend. So, okay, so let you off. You're the daughter of his good friend, let you off. Not again and again. After a while, the merit runs out. However, what never runs out is bris avos, right? The covenant, the bris avos, that doesn't run out. A covenant is permanent. And... so that's also sort of a background theme to this kino. I'll just point out it's important to notice at the end. Okay, ultimately we don't understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did, but now we turn and we do understand it because we say at the end there's almost a vidui. The last stanza, Atah Tzadik Al Kol Habo, L'cho Hashem Atztoka. Okay, we write Ki Kol Zos Bo'asnu B'chova. All the things that we've been lamenting about, the personal things and so on and so forth. It come to us because we've deserved it. And that leads right into the next kin, a Yud Tes. We'll say them back to back because in Yud Tes we have the two phrases, L'cho Hashem Atztoka, V'lanu Boshes upon him. L'cho Hashem Atztoka, you're right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because of the things you did for us, and V'lanu Boshes upon him. We're embarrassed because we behaved in such a way. So here we find like a shift, so to speak, a little bit in the theme where up until now we've been asking, Eicha, how could this be? How could this happen? Why did this happen? And why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow this to happen? And you know, almost as I say, in a challenging kind of way, in a place which, you know, in a manner which might otherwise be considered to be a chutzpah, but we ask it, okay? But at the end of the day, we now come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we say, we recognize the end of Kina, the end of Kina Yurches, L'chosh, Tot Tzadik Al Kalabo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is righteous, and everything was, that happened to us, and Kol Zos Bo'as Mechovo, we deserve everything, and now the Vidui, now the Vidui, okay? And we say, you know, after all the shock and protesting and anger and all the terrible things that have happened, and again, happened throughout the generations, okay, it happened throughout the generations, not just once, but ultimately we recognize that we're to be embarrassed. Lanu Boshes Haponim, we're embarrassed by what has taken place because of the way we behaved. So we'll now say these two kinnis back to back, Kinnis Yud Zayin and Yud Ches. I'm sorry, Kinnis Yud Ches and Yud Tes. And the Kinachov, which is Kinachov begins Hate Elokai Oznecha, we said in Shul. All right, so therefore we will continue in a few moments with Kinna number Chaf Aleph, number 21, which is Arze Halavana, and the Kinna about the Asura Aruge Malchus. We'll continue now with the Kinna of Arze Halavana, Kinna number 21. Of Aleph, again in this edition, it's on page 248. Arzi Alavon and Adir HaTorah, this is the kinna concerning the famous Asara Hagri Malchus, which we read about not only on Tisha B'Av, but of course on Yom Kippur afternoon as well, as part of the Avoda on Yom Kippur at the end of the Slichas section. Actually, the greater detail is found in that one, interestingly enough, in that version of the story. We all know the basic story, but it fits in with what we said before, that the goal of the Romans was not simply to destroy the Beis Hamikdash, to destroy the Jewish people as a nation, but to embarrass and to humiliate us as a people, as a religious people. And, you know, the Romans realized, as I alluded to before, 50, 60 years after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, the Jewish people still rebelled and wanted to build another Beis Hamikdash. They realized that they had been unsuccessful with the Jews as they were with other nations. They were unsuccessful in the sense that they did not destroy the Jewish religion. They kept the Jewish people kept their religion alive in the face of the Roman tragedy. The Romans felt, okay, once there's no more Beis Hamikdash, once no more temple, so that's it. What are they going to hold on to? What are they going to do? You know, but Klal Yisrael continued. And they continued because of the Talmidei Chachamim. It's very interesting that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Gemara tells us, surrendered Yerushalayim. Made a very, very difficult decision. Surrendered Yerushalayim knowing that it was going to lead to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And people wondered why he didn't ask, you know, why he didn't try and spare the Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a deal with Vespasian, the Gemara tells us, when Vespasian was the general who had surrounded Yerushalayim. Yochanan Zakkai struck a deal with him. We know the story. He had to sneak out of the city because the zealots didn't want Yochanan Zakkai to make any deal with anybody. They wanted to fight till the end, which Yochanan Zakkai felt was pointless because we're going to lose. More lives will be lost. So he wanted to make a treaty. He wanted to make a deal with the Vespasian. And he did. But he did not ask him to spare the Beis HaMikdash. And people wondered why he didn't. And he explained, Chazal tell us, because he knew they wouldn't give in on that. They wouldn't allow it. Tafas tamurba lo tafas. You can't ask for too much. So they won't get it. You'll end up with less. So therefore, but what he did do was he saved. He saved the Talmidei Chachamim, right? He saved, he said, Tein li yavne v'chachamel. Let the Jewish Sanhedrin and so on, the Jewish Batei Medrash reestablish themselves in Yavne. Leave Yavne alone. He also said, leave the family of Gamliel alone, right? He included the Nesius. And the Siyam, you know, from the Malchus Beis David and so on, or a little descended from. So that he did. And the Romans now, 50 or 60 years later, realized, perhaps, that that was a mistake, because that prevented them from ultimately achieving their goal to eradicate the Jewish religion, not just the Jewish people as an independent political nation, but as a religious nation. They failed in that regard. The Haraya, the Jews were rebelling still and wanted to build another Beis HaMikdash 50 or 60 or so years later, in the time of Bar Kokhba. So at that time that the Romans decided, if we want to get to the Jews, we've got to get rid of their religious leaders. And that's the backdrop of the Asara Haruge Malchus. Now, historically speaking, these 10 rabbis were enumerated, not all of whom are actually enumerated here, but the so-called Asara Haruge Malchus were not executed at one time the way the stories and the Medrash kind of presents it. In fact, they didn't all live in the same generation. It was close, but they didn't all live at the same time. Shmuel Kohen Gadol and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, those were earlier, generation earlier, but the idea was the same. The idea was to get, if they realized that if they, the strength of the Jews dependent on their Torah leadership, on the Torah learning, and not on a physical place, not on a Beis HaMikdash. We said the Beis HaMikdash can be replicated to a certain extent in all other places throughout the world. So that's the backdrop of the story of the Asura HaGemalchus. Again, this story is presented differently here. Kippur, the presentation relates to tshuva, so perhaps the details relate more to that. Here, it's not so much the tshuva notion, but the avelus notion. And the idea also comes into play that the loss of righteous people is comparable to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Why is that true? Because, as I said before, the Beis HaMikdash can be replicated and the same goals achieved through Torah, even without a physical place. We miss it, we need it, but it's not indispensable. Torah is indispensable. And the Romans finally recognized that Torah was indispensable. That's why I tried to get rid of the Torah leaders. And we find other occasions, banned Torah study and so on. But that's the backdrop of the Asura HaGemalchus, which included, of course, Rabbi Akiva and many other of the great well-known Tanaim, who met this unfortunate end in this negative fashion, and an attempt on the part of the Romans to eradicate Torah from the Jews, recognizing that Torah just keeps us going, not even as important a place as the Beis HaMikdash. Even more important than that is the Torah. And we'll continue now with Kinah Chaf Aleph Arzei Halavanon. Next Kinah Chaf Beis Achrishim Menav Adabera also represents, so to speak, a little shift. We spoke before that whereas all the earlier kinos were kinos of great lamentation, of anguish, of mourning, of screaming, how could HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow this to happen, and so on and so forth. And we shift a little bit to the sense of doing of tshuva, of admitting our mistakes and so on. And then we shifted with the last kinah, the kinah of the Asura HaGemalchus, to a disaster which probably had nothing to do with Tisha B'Av per se. We have no indication that this happened on Tisha B'Av, but it was indicative of the goal, the Jewish enemies, to wipe out not only the Jewish people as a nation, but the Jewish religion as well. There's another shift here in terms of the topics covered by the kinos, starting here with Kinah Chaf Beis, which describes what would appear a city that was massacred probably in the time of the Crusades. I mentioned earlier this morning that date of Tisha B'Av is at Yom HaMuchan L'Poraneh, it's a day set aside for disaster, and it's our practice to mourn other tragedies, even if they didn't on Tisha B'Av, even if it didn't happen on the ninth day of Av itself. Many tragedies did happen the ninth of Av. I mentioned this morning, probably you've all seen lists, and you can access them in history books and so on, a list of things that all that happened on the ninth of Av, well after, aside from the five things that are mentioned in the Mishnah in Tainus. Okay, but many things that happened long after that, down to modern times. I mean, first of all, the expulsion from Spain in 1492, but down to modern times, you know, the breakout of World War I was on Tisha B'Av, you know, from which ultimately came the Holocaust and so on. So many tragedies happened on Tisha B'Av, on the 9th of the actual calendar date. However, our practice is to mourn even events that did not happen on the calendar date, the 9th of Av. We mourn them on Tisha B'Av as well. So that's what we see in this kinah and another kinah that we'll see, the Crusades. As I mentioned this morning, had nothing to do with Tisha B'Av. They happened in the springtime. Usually, the mission of the Crusaders was to get from Europe to the Holy Land. And, of course, they decided to massacre a lot of Jews along the way. But, the roads in the wintertime were full of snow and water and ice and everything else, and mud, they're impassable. It was only in the springtime that now the things were clear a little bit. You could travel. They're talking about the ancient world, obviously. So the roads were better. And so that's when they set out in the springtime. So many of the massacres that we read about or we know about from the Crusades happened in the springtime, happened Shavuos time. Some of the kinahs mentioned dates, specific dates as to when the kinah happened. It wasn't the ninth of Av, but nevertheless, on Tisha B'Av is when they mourn this particular tragedy. And as such, Soloveitchik said these kinos about the Crusades are not mourning simply the loss of those Jews who were murdered in Magenza and Spires and Vermeisa, Mainz, Spires and Warren, but also those massacred many years later in Warsaw and in Vilna, you know, Jewish communities and so on. And but the one thing about the Crusades that the Rav noted, you know, he said that this was the time of the so-called Balei HaTosfos, Rashi and his students. The Torah level was pretty low in the days of Rashi. Rashi was born in France. There's no place for him to learn in France, really. He had to go to the yeshivas, and the centers were in Germany. Okay, the centers were in Germany. Later, he came back to France, but he had to move to Germany because that's where the center of Torah scholarship was. And it was really Germany that was destroyed during the time of the Crusades, many, many great communities, but Germany remained the center of Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Rav, perhaps somewhat surprisingly, made the comment that if Jewish history had not included the Rambam, okay, so we would have missed a tremendous amount. Okay, we know what Rambam has done to enrich our thinking, our worldview, and so on, our understanding of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But, said the Rav, we could have survived without that. Could not have survived as a people without Rashi and Tosis. Could not have survived, okay, as a religious people, because their interpretation, their presentation of the Torah Sheba'al Peh is indispensable. The Rambam made, obviously, major contributions, and nobody, I'm sure, was aware of that more than the Rav. But he said, nonetheless, he said it's really the Torah Sheba'al Peh would not have survived without Rashi and Tosis making it accessible and pioneering a way of thinking and so on. They're very, very strong. All this happened during the Crusades. There are Crusaders. I don't know if the Rav mentioned this or not, but I remember reading, I think it was Abelezer Rokech, the Rokech, one of the Rishonim, I think it was he, who wrote that he saw his own children executed in front of his eyes. You know, this was going on at the time, that people persevered and contributed to Torah, the future of Torah, maintained Torah Sheba'al Peh, in the face of unspeakable personal tragedy. And there were others. It wasn't just the Rokech. I looked a little bit last night. I couldn't find the source, but I do know that some of them had suffered unspeakable tragedies. I would add, okay, that as a matter of fact, there are, and this we know, there are tshuvas in the writings that we've shown him about whether parents have the right to slaughter their own children rather than, you know, in order to prevent them from being taken by the Christians, you know, and baptized and so on and so forth. It's really a staggering. You know, it's a staggering thing, okay? It's you know, the author of this kinnah, in one of the stands, writes, B'lili chol avodah zarah, it justifies the practice. Okay, they were shown him discuss it. But I'm just saying, these are the unbelievable things, unbelievable daily life that people have to live with, and yet they maintained all of Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's very, very fascinating, to ponder that. And again, it also, and this I'll finish, we'll say the kinnah, highlights the notion of not losing sight of the individual suffering. I can't stress it enough. We tend, when thinking about Tisha B'Av and the 9 days and mourning, we talk about the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and we struggle to, you know, to feel the sense of Velus. We're supposed to feel it's all true. We're supposed to mourn the absence of the Beis HaMikdash and contemplate what the Beis HaMikdash means and what its absence represents and so on and so forth. I'm not taking away from that. But we tend to lose sight of the individual personal tragedy, personal suffering. And I dare say, and I started at the beginning, I spoke about, you know, an experience when I went to Poland a few times now, you know, to see some of these sites there. You know, we almost casually, and I'm not saying, I'm not criticizing anybody, it's natural, but we almost casually throw around the number 6 million. 6 million people, 6 million Jews died. You stop and think for a moment. You know, I went all the times I go into Poland, I went with an organization called Names Not Numbers, which is such a great title. Names, not, no, these are people. These are people. You know, we throw the number out, 6 million, 6 million. These are human beings, you know, who had dreams and goals. I tell this to the high school students, you know, many of them, they say to the high school students, in the yeshiva, they're your age, and they had friends, and they had hobbies, and they had activities they enjoyed doing, and they had dreams for their lives and hopes, just like you do. You know, we tend to lose sight of that sometimes. So some of the kinnas, I think, are designed to remind us not only the general sense of avelus and mourning the Beis HaMikdash, but focusing as well on the personal tragedy and trying to personalize it. And one of the previous kinnas we read about, in the Alalai Li kinnah, about, you know, the girls were tied by their hair to the tails of horses and so on. I mentioned in previous years, I won't say it all now because it's late, but Soloveitchik said it happened to a cousin of his that he knew, okay? And it was, except it wasn't a horse, it was the back of a car. Okay, he and his young Kala, this cousin of Rav Soloveitchik, a relative of his, was tied to the back of a car together with his new Kala, and they drove the car through the streets. You know, while they were bouncing around the back of the car, I don't have to tell you what happened to them. This was something that the people suffered on a personal kind of level. We cannot lose sight of that as we mourn on Tisha B'Av as well. Not only the Churban Beis Hamikdash, but as in this Kinnah Chaf Beis, other tragedies, the Crusades, and other tragedies. On the personal and on the national level. The next kina chav gimel, Vesnavicha Tasi Yishmima, is a kina on the regarding the story that appears in the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Nun Ches about the son and the daughter of Rabbi Shmuel, each of whom was taken captive by a different Roman captor, and they ended up living next door to each other, each one not realizing that the sibling was next door. And the two Roman officers or soldiers who kidnapped them or who got them or purchased them as slaves felt to be a good idea to match them up with each other and therefore produce slave children and so on. And so they were told that they have to marry each other, so to speak, and were locked together, and neither could see each other in a dark room. And the young man saying, how could a descendant of Kahuna possibly be married to now and have to be with a woman who was a slave? And she said, how could the daughter of a Kohen Gadol take as her husband somebody who's a slave, and so on and so forth? And they realized in the morning, each one realized who the other one was, and they died in their embrace together. Again, this kina is from the Churban period, and so seem a little strange to mention this here after the kina, which talked about the Crusades and the events of the Crusades, which were of course much later. But again, it fits in the theme we've discussed the last couple of kinas, focusing on personal tragedy. The Rav Soloveitchik put it. He said that our concept of mourning is that we mourn the loss of every individual. Doesn't matter whether the individual is that important or not. Rabbi Shmuel, the Kohen Gadol, was important, but these children were young children. They were orphans. We don't know anything about them other than this story. They were not necessarily important people per se, but it doesn't matter. Okay, when we focus on major disasters and major calamities, we focus as well on a story about some young man, random young man. We're not quite random. They were from the important family. But they were not necessarily important people themselves. They were not necessarily people whose activities in life and death would have had a major impact in the world, and even in the Jewish world. We mourn them as well. Okay. In addition to mourning the communities of Germany that were destroyed during the Crusades, we focus on the individual tragedy, individual loss as well. Every Jew is important. And that's something that continues down to this day. I mean, Rachmana Litzlan, hopefully you won't hear it, but every once in a while when we hear some story in Eretz Yisrael where perhaps a kid was taken away or something, the whole Jewish community mobilized. The whole Jewish community cares. Okay, when we hear Nebuch of some tragedy in Eretz Yisrael, we're all touched by it. It hits us, doesn't matter. It's a random kid. It's a random family that has nothing to do with anybody, nothing to do with the people that we know. We don't know them. We've never met them, and so on, but we'll meet them. But it doesn't matter. They're part. We mourn together with them, and that's what this kina is about. Also, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out human nature. Human nature is that it's easier to feel sad and touched and moved when you personalize a story. When you talk about a major disaster, a major calamity in the general sense, so you feel bad, but it doesn't touch you personally. Then you hear a story about a personal suffering, it kind of hits you, right? That's human nature. I'm not saying anything bad. It's human nature. We respond more when there is a, when it's a personal kind of story. Than when it's a more general story. And Rav Soloveitchik referred to a medrash in Parshas Noach that Rabbi Akiva once came to a certain city on a fundraising mission. I guess the Tanaim also had to raise funds for the yeshivas. So Rabbi Akiva came to raise funds, and he gave a drasha in the community, gave a speech to everybody, and he spoke about the suffering of the world. And it was Parshas Noach time, apparently. He spoke about the suffering, how all of mankind was drowned and so on and so forth. And, you'd think that's a terrible calamity, which it was, but apparently it didn't move the people too much. The world was destroyed. But then he told the story of the suffering of Eov And people immediately broke down in tears and contributed to Bekiva's, you know, cause and so on. And Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that's human nature. Okay, when people hear something on a personal level, it's much more touching and much more moving than on a national level. And so that's why in Tisha B'Av, as we do mourn, we have many kinnis on the national suffering. There are kinnis on the individual suffering as well, that puts us into a mood in a way perhaps we can respond to it or react to it even more poignantly. Continue now with kinnah number 23. Kinnah 24, Al-Churban Beis Hamikdash, Kihuras V'Chudash, is also written by Rabbi Elazar Kalir. And here I don't really have a good explanation as to why it's, you know, why it appears here. It would have been more appropriate perhaps to mention it earlier. This kinnah talks about the, just a moment. Yeah. This kinnah talks about the Klei HaMikdash, the different vessels of the Mikdash, which were plundered as well. Look in the stanza which begins Kuf Kodesh HaKadosh, Beis Kodesh Kenirdad, and so on. And Tzadi Chol Klei Chemda Iva Beis HaOtor, all the beautiful vessels of the Beis HaMikdash were taken away. So it really would have appeared to have belonged earlier. Unless it's not really focusing so much on, on the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, but on the fact that the enemies, like I said before, wanted to take things away that we would not have them anymore. The vessels of the Beis HaMikdash were plundered, and again, I don't have a good explanation why this kin is here instead of earlier on, unless I said it was to show that they've conquered not only the Jewish people as a nation, but the Jewish people as a religious people, and they defiled the Kelim of the Mikdash. We know from Megillas Esther, the first parak, it says that Ahasuerosh, after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, had some of the Kelim, Mekelim, Mekelim, Shonim. It says in the first parak of Megillas Esther, we learned that in the Eichot Rop, so they took those Kelim away and misused them or abused them. But again, I don't have a good explanation why this kin is here. The Chorot should have been part of the earlier kinna. One of the earlier kinnas talks about the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And again, because after that we speak about the Crusades and then some of the other events, also even if relating to the Churban, which were a different type of represent a different type of presentation. And so again, I don't have a good answer, but nevertheless, that's the kinna we're up to. Kinna Chav Dalad Al Churban Beis HaMikdash Kihuras V'Chihudash. Kinnah Chof Hei, Miyatein Rosh Yimayim, is one of the most prominent kinnos relating to the Crusades, with a lot of details. And again, I mentioned that the practice that we have is to mourn all tragedies, even if they didn't happen on Tisha B'Av. And I suggested that there's perhaps even a makor for this in the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Tainus records the five tragedies that happened on Tisha B'Av. And the fifth of which, well, the first again is this decision that the Dor HaMidbar would not go into Eretz Yisrael in the wake of the Chet HaMaragan. The second and third were the destruction of Beis HaMikdash number 1, number 2. Tragedy number 4, the destruction of the city of Beitar, loss of tens of thousands of Jewish lives, to the point the Gemara tells us in Gittin that so much blood spilled that it flowed all the way from Beitar to the ocean. The Mediterranean, even if that's an exaggeration, a lot of blood was spilled. And the fifth thing is that the city was plowed over. As the Pasuk says, Micha prophesied, Tzion Sada Techoresh, and they're mentioned in terms of Rekiva and his colleagues seeing that themselves. Rekiva invokes that Pasuk in the end of Makkos on Daf Chav Talmud Beis. Anyway, the question is, when was the city overturned? When was this concept of a Nechresho Ir, and by whom? It's not really clear in the mission at all. The Gemara seems to say it was done by a Roman governor I mentioned last night named Turnus Rufus, who was, according to Josephus, there was a Turnus Rufus at the time of the Churban, but it would appear that was not the one who overturned the city. It would appear that it was a Turnus Rufus who was a governor in the time of the Bar Kokh, a Roman governor in Eretz Yisrael, at the time of the Churban, destruction of Beitar, and then the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba rebellion and so on. That's probably the Turnus Rufus. He had a lot to do with Rabbi Akiva. We have a number of places in the Gemara where Turnus Rufus speaks to Rabbi Akiva. It was at that time, and based on a diuk that I have in the Gemara. The Gemara never specifically, according to our Girsa, says that Nechresh O'ir took place on the calendar day Tisha B'Av. By all the other things that it says in the Mishnah, it happened on Tisha B'Av. And similarly, by all the things that the same Mishnah in Tainus says happened on Shavuos Tammuz, the Gemara asks, how do we know that it happened on that date? And each time the Gemara gives an answer, either it's Psukim, or it's an oral tradition. The Gemara says Gemara, means it's an oral tradition. It, according to our Girsa, again, not everyone agrees with Rechananel has a different Girsa, the Miri seems to have a different Girsa, but according to our Girsa, the Gemara in Tainus, Chavtes and Aleph, the Gemara itself never asked that question, how do we know that Nechresh O'ir, the city was overturned on Tisha B'Av? Never says that, nor does it give an answer, never asks the question, just goes on to discuss. So it got me thinking that perhaps it didn't actually happen on Tisha B'Av per se, but we mourn it on Tisha B'Av, and hence the practice to take Tisha B'Av and use Tisha B'Av as a day of Avelis, not only for things that happen on the 9th of Av, but for things that happen, other tragedies, even they didn't happen on that particular date. And so this kinnah, number 25, Mitain Rosh Yimayim, is the so-called Xeris Tatnu, 1096, that was the crusade, the time of the crusades. And, this is having a refrain, Al Beis Yisrael Al Hashem, Kinoful Bechorev. It mentions here the dates. It says, Besrimu Shlosha Bechodesh Ziv, for example, when discussing the Kahal Vermaisa, the 23rd of the month of Iyar. Okay, Bechodesh Ashlishi Bekriyas Halal, the third month, we said Halal. That's the Sivan. We say Halal on the third, on Sivan, on Shavuos, right? Bechodesh Ashlishi Beshlishi, and so on. The names, the cities, the names, the places, again, nothing to do per se with Tisha B'Av, but we mourn these events on Tisha B'Av as well, because it's a national day of mourning, even for events that didn't happen on the 9th of Av. Kinnah number 25. The next two kinnahs, Chav Vav and Chav Zayin, go together, really. In the art scroll order, and most of the orders, it has Oz V'Aloch Yimiyol Kibre Avos as Chav Vav, and Chav Zayin is Oz Mo Sefek Yofek Kasirtso. Really, it would appear that the Chav Zayin would go first because it's in Chav Zayin, in Osmolo Sefik, that somebody appears before Yirmiyahu, and Yirmiyahu, of course, being the Navi that was alive and witnessed, Ani Agebe Ra'oni, he was alive at the time of the Chorban, and somebody who has a strange, kind of a strange appearance, appears in front of him, and basically, not really sure whether to the Malach or a Shade or something, but rather this person represents Kal Yisrael as it's as the Kinnah describes in the Kinnah Chav Zayin, and this person, this woman, tells him, "Go, what are you sitting here? The Beis Hamikdash is being destroyed. Go and appeal, right? Go and appeal before the Avos and ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for Rachamim." And the next Kinnah, which again by us is printed first, Kinnah Chavav, begins Oz Baruch Yirmiyo al Kibri Avos. Yirmiyo responds, and indeed he goes to the Maros Machpelah, to the Kibri Avos, and he pleads and he asks for the Zechus Avos. We spoke about that before, and what happened to the Haftachas, to the Avos, and so on. Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov will try to help. Moshe Rabbeinu tries to help. No one does anything. No one responds. And finally, it ends with Rachel. Although it's interesting, this particular Kinnah ends not only with Rachel crying, but also Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah. Okay, crying, and of course, Baruch Hu responds to them. We usually assume it's just Rachel, but this kinnah has it that Baruch Hu responds to all four of those wives of Yaakov Avinu. But in any event, so probably Chav Zayin belongs before Chav Vav. Nevertheless, we'll say, I mean, it doesn't matter. You can say, we'll say them together now. You can say whichever order you want personally. Again, there's the printed text, and there's what's probably correct. But at the end, it says, of the one about Yirmiyahu going to the Kibri Avos. And of course, some suggest the Yirmiyahu didn't want to go to the Kibri Avos originally because he was embarrassed, right? This happened on his watch, right? Of all the great leaders of Klal Yisrael, nobody saw the Chorban Beis HaMikdash but him. It's also interesting that there's a Medrash I saw for the first time this year. It's a Chidoch quotes. It's not in the standard compendium of Medrash that we have, that I know of. There's a collection of Midrashim was put together by a Rav, a Tamachach, in the beginning of the 20th century, Rabbi J.D. Eisenstein, Otzer Midrashim. He has a number of this farm, we'll call Otzer of this and Otzer of that, the treasure. It's really very fascinating how he compiled all this stuff. But he has an Otzer Midrashim, so it appears in his Otzer Midrashim, and the Chidoch quotes it in a couple of places, in his parish of Yo, and his parish of the Gemara in Tainus, a different Sfarim. The Chidoch wrote many, many Sfarim. So the Chidoch quotes it, the Medrash, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent Yirmiyahu out of Yerushalayim, told him to go back to Anasos. Anasos is the city where Yirmiyahu came from. Like we said a few weeks ago, we read the first of the three haftarahs of the 3 weeks. Dira Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyo, I mean, Akonim Asher Banasos. Anasos, that's the name of the place that he lived. So Kadosh Baruch Hu told, according to this medrash, Yirmiyahu had to leave Yerushalayim because the enemy wasn't going to be able to come in until as long as Yirmiyahu was there. So the enemy didn't come in. Then Yirmiyahu left the city, and he saw, went home as it was directed by Kadosh Baruch Hu. And then the enemy came in, and Yirmiyahu began to return to Yerushalayim, and he saw the city burning and so on. The fascinating medrash. According to that medrash, he and Nebuchadnezzar had known each other as younger men. And the Nebuchadnezzar originally was not from a prominent family. He was not from a rich or significant background. But he had grand ambitions even then. And he told Yirmiyahu that if I ever become the emperor, I'm going to destroy this whole place. Yirmiyahu said, "Will you let me keep anything? Will you let me keep the temple, the Beis Hamikdash?" He said, "No, will you let me keep this? No, let me keep that. What will you let me keep?" He said, "Whatever you can take out of town before the end of the day, before the sun sets." So Yirmiyahu, according to this medrash, ran back to Yerushalayim and saved whatever he could. I mean, it's interesting medrash. But this kinnah doesn't seem to present it that way. This kinnah seems to say that Yirmiyahu was around and was visited by this unusual-looking woman who represented all of Klal Yisrael and begged him to go ask the Avos, which he did. Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't respond to the Avos, but instead to the Imos, whether according to our a standard version was Rachel alone, or according to this medrash, this kinna, not only Rachel, but Rachel and Leah and Bill and Zilpah. And we'll say the two kinnas together now, Chav Vav and Chav Zayin. Continuing now with kina number 28, Chavches, Eich Tenachamuni Havel. This is a kina also from Beleza Kalir, who basically focuses upon how, how futile it is to try and receive comfort. Eich Anachem, all the tragedies happening. But actually what he does is he lists a group of different tragedies, different sufferings that the Jews experience at the hands of the Greeks. Actually, before that, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, an earlier Moab and Ammon, and he's frustrated and says, Eich Anachem. And Soloveitchik used this opportunity to point out that, and he didn't give this example, but I'm giving it, that B'chol Dar V'Dar Om D'Malein L'Chal Hosein, like we say in the Pesach Seder by V'Hisha Omda, in every generation. And he says that some of these kinnas weave the events of the first Beis Hamikdash, the events of the second Beis Hamikdash, and because, it's because there is so many different things happen, that's the destiny of the Jewish people, the particular details of the name and the place, names and place and so on are unimportant. I want to read to you from Soloveitchik's words, okay, because it's very, very powerful, I think. He says, sometimes our enemy takes the guise of the king of Babylonia. Sometimes he appears in a different era, in a different place, with a different language. And his name is Edom, but he's the same. Our enemy is still alive. He has not reconciled himself to the existence of the Jewish people. We spoke about that theme throughout here. When Yaakov Avinu struggled with the mysterious stranger, that Malach that he wrestled with that night, the Torah tells us that Yaakov asked him his name, okay? Because he wanted to determine, as Soloveitchik says, he could not determine what nature the person stranger was. On the one hand, according to the Gemara, he appeared as a Talmud Chacham in one way. On the other hand, he was a poor shepherd. And it says, and back to the words of Soloveitchik, when Jacob asked his name, the stranger replied, in effect, it makes no difference who I am. Wherever I am, I have one mission, and that is to defy you. My mission is to oppose your return to the land of Israel and the development of people in Israel. Similarly, the Rav added, the Gemara often will begin with a story about the first Beis Hamikdash and conclude by discussing the second Beis Hamikdash. The Chachamim were well aware of the correct sequence of events, okay, and of chronology, and their intermingling of the chronology, the Rav writes, was deliberate. The depiction of multiple events without regard to chronology is an expression of the drama of Jewish history in which events repeat themselves. The names and dates and the places may change, but it's one continuing drama. And that's the idea that, again, we have enemies and it doesn't make a difference. It's b'chol dor v'dor, om nivaleinu l'chal oseinu. Then he added something else. The deliberate imprecision of the chronological sequence contains an additional message. It's an expression of avelus. As long as one's memory of time functions properly, avelus does not reach its height. When one lives through a fateful period, when one is in despair, one cannot be concerned with the calendar. Okay, one has to make a mistake. It's a very interesting thing when you're so arangetum, when you're so wrapped up in suffering, you can't even pay attention to a date. In fact, the Rebbe went on to demonstrate that, you know, by the Gemara says that the first, that the walls of the city of Yerushalayim were breached on Shavuos HaBetamuz, on the 17th of Tammuz, and that's why we fast. One of the things that happened, that's why we fast on Shavuos HaBetamuz. But if you look in the Psukim in Navi, in Melachim Beis, and also in Yirmiyahu, it says that the walls were breached on the 9th of Tammuz, not the 17th. So what's going on? So the Bavli answers that in the first Beis HaMikdash was Taka the 9th, the second Beis HaMikdash was the 17th. So we mourn today the second Beis HaMikdash, and it's difficult for people to have two fast days within the week, the 9th and the 17th, too much. So they made it on the 17th. But the Yerushalmi gives a different teretz. The Yerushalmi says that it was the Medrash also says it was the 17th, but the people thought it was 9th. Their whole concept of calendar, the whole concept of time was mixed up. And as I said before, I guess it was cloudy, so they couldn't tell based on the moon. Or maybe even they could have told by the moon. They couldn't focus on the calendar. When a person is mourning, when a person is Arayin Gittin, is wrapped up in his Avelis, and it's difficult to note time. And that's maybe why some of these kinnas go back and forth and interweave a lot of different tragedies together, because it highlights the notion of Avelis. Kinnah number 28, we'll continue now. Kinnah number Chofches, each standard ending Ve'echan Achem, and finally, Rakash Baruch Hu will come back to us Ve'ozen Achem. Next, Kinnah Choftes goes back to the Crusades, begins with the words Amarti Shumeni. I said, turn away from me, Rabbi Chia Morera. I want to express my bitterness of a week. This is perhaps the second crusade, describes really again the persecution, the slaughter relating to the crusades. It's interesting, in the art school kinnas, they point out that there are a number of different discrepancies in the text of this particular kinnah. They point them out because this kinnah since it speaks about the Crusades, the Christians, and so on and so forth, so the censors had a hand in it. So say this kinnah in one moment. I just want to point out the last phrase of the kinnah is Shnas Gulai Ba'a, which is a pasuk in Yeshaya, it's from one of the Shiva Nechemta. Okay, Shnas Gulai Ba'a. Okay, Ba'a doesn't mean will come, but it means has arrived. Right, Rachel Ba'a Yematzon. We have Ba'a and Ba'a, two different ways to pronounce it, makes a big difference. And people wonder why we say Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. Okay, why don't we say Lashana Hazos B'Yerushalayim? What's Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim? Why Lashana Hazos? We should always say Lashana Hazos B'Yerushalayim, and yet we always say Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. What's Pshat? So some say it means Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim means at this time next year. Whenever we say Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim at the end of the Seder on Pesach, we say it at the end of the Nila and Yom Kippur. So it means at this time next year, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. But some suggest, and no, it depends how you pronounce the word Ba. If you pronounce it the way that means not will arrive, okay, the next year, but the one that has arrived, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim means maybe the year that has arrived. So maybe that's what this pasuk means as well. Shnas Gulai Ba'a means that we'll say it means that the city, the redemption has already arrived. Kinnah number Choftes, Amarti Shomini. The next kinnah Lamed, Ma'onei Shemaim Shechokim Zbelucha. Each stanza ends with the word Bayis, referring to the Beis HaMikdash. Of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to, as we mentioned earlier, be mitzamtzem himself. He had to, so to speak, in Kabbalistic terms, limit himself. But again, it's not only a Kabbalah, it's in the Midrashim already, that speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, limiting himself to be able to be contained in a bias. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Moloch HaAretz Kvodo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu fills the whole universe, but he kind of, limited himself or shrunk himself, so to speak, to be able to fit into the bias. And that's actually when Shlomo HaMelech davened or spoke in the context of the celebration after building the first Beis HaMikdash. He expressed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't really be contained in any house. Nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu for us did this. On the other hand, we recognize, I mentioned earlier, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is really everywhere. Kadosh Baruch Hu exists even without the Beis HaMikdash. And it's not the house, it's not the place, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We've mentioned on many occasions, this is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sometimes referred to as HaMakom. Like we say, Rachman Otzam, when somebody's observing Shiva, we say HaMakom Yenachem Eschem HaMakom. HaMakom means the omnipresent. He's present every place. And the question is, you know, there are a lot of nicknames for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Rabbeinu Shalom, a lot of other names. Why, when we pay somebody a Shiva visit, we say HaMakom Yenach, we use that particular nickname. So Rav Soloveitchik explained that because when a person feels that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is far away from him, that's when we say HaMakom. Right, and so a person who's sitting Shiva, God forbid, if the death of a relative feels like Kadosh Baruch Hu perhaps abandoned him and his family. So we say HaMakom, not Kadosh Baruch Hu is here. Okay, and we say Dafka B'Soch Sharei LeTzion Yerushalayim. It's HaMakom, it's not Tzion Yerushalayim, it's not the building, it's not even the city. Kadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere, it's Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's what's important. And or when we speak about Jews suffering throughout the world, we say Achina Kol Beisyon Asunu Metzora Shiva Hamdim Bein Ba'am Bein Ba'Basha HaMakom Yirachem Aleim B'Yotzei Metzora Lavacha HaMakom. Again, people feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has abandoned them, so we say HaMakom, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is here. He'll have mercy on you and so on. And even on Kol Nidre night, on the night of Kol Nidre, when we are about to start and we feel very far away from God, we feel like there's a mechitza, you know, partition blocking our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of all our virus. What do we say at the beginning of Kol Nidre? B'yeshiva shalmala, b'yeshiva shalmata, al da'as ha-mokom, al da'as ha-kol. We begin for HaKadosh Baruch Hu as mokom. This was the lesson that Soloveitchik pointed out that Rekiva taught Klal Yisrael. You know, there's a mission at the end of Yuma that said, and we all know it because it's a song, right? Amar Rekiva, ashreichem Yisrael, ifnei mi'atam mitarem and mitar eschem. We're fortunate. Who purifies us? Kadosh Baruch Hu purifies us. Avinu Shabbat Shemaim. So the question is, what's the Bekiva's Chiddush? At the Pasuk, he quotes a Pasuk, right? Two Pesukim, actually. So what's the Chiddush? Amar Bekiva, big Chiddush from Bekiva. Bekiva comes and says, we're fortunate Jewish people because Kadosh Baruch Hu is Metaher us. Shkach. I mean, what's new? What did he say that we didn't know? So the Soloveitchik explained, because Bekiva lived in a time after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So imagine the first few Yom Kippurs after the first Beis HaMikdash, when there was no avoda and no red thread turning white and no karbanas and no. Imagine, you know, people were full of despair. Like, what's going to atone for our errors now that there's no Beis HaMikdash? King Rabbi Akiva said, "It's not the Beis HaMikdash. It's not the avoda. It's Avichem Shav Shemaim. It's Hakadosh Baruch Hu." Right, that's what we have to be reminded of. So that's perhaps, you know, this kinnah, which speaks about the bias, the place, the house, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu limited himself to, so to speak, for our benefit. But that's not really where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere. He's everywhere we can find him. And we wait for the time when he'll come back, right? Hinei Kvod Hashem and Baal HaBayis. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring his glory back to the bias, but we can access him even without that. Kinnah number 30, Bona Shemayim. Next kinnah Lamed Aleph, is the famous kinnah contrasting our departure from Mitzrayim to our departure from Yerushalayim, our departure from Mitzrayim on the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which again, of course, according to our calendar, is always the same night as the night of Tisha B'Av in that particular year. Pesach this year is, you recall, the first Seder was a Wednesday night, first day of Pesach was Thursday, so too Tisha B'Av. And their parallels were, of course, the opposite. It's the opposite idea. We left Mitzrayim with great fanfare, with great excitement, with great pageantry, with great drama, and so on. And we leave Yerushalayim with great mourning and great sadness, and so on. And it's an easy to understand kinnah, very one of the more moving kinnahs that we have. And if you want to unmute yourself to sing along, we have a traditional tune that we use. You can unmute yourself if you wish. Nobody has to. I'm not going to impose on anybody, but you can unmute yourself if you wish for this kinnah. And otherwise, we'll join together, and we'll say Kinnah Lamed Aleph. Each stands again, B'tzeisim Mitzrayim versus B'tzeisim Yerushalayim. Well, it ends at the very end with the Havtacha of Sasam Simcha Benos Yagom Aracha when we return to Yerushalayim. So we'll say together now Kinnah Lamed Aleph again. If you wish to unmute yourself, you can, although you don't, you definitely don't have to. Kinnah Lamed Aleph. Eshtu kad bekir bimahalosi ali bimitzayse mimitzrayim kini imayiru alamahan aski kabutayti rushalayim az yashir moshe shir lo yinashe bitzayse mimitzrayim Ikone nearly of the honey of the taste in Yerushalayim. Basie his cone on the Shochan on the taste in Mitzrayim. Hamas of Shoch all I can on the taste in Yerushalayim. Alayam Ram Hamakamu. The taste in Mitzrayim. The Gan Shamay, Mitroyot of my in Betay, same in Mitroyim. My Amorim,
The next Ken Lamed Beis
It's both Shaflu ends each stanza Oya and Oya Oya Oy Meheolanu, just a groan, a calling out of you know, of suffering, of pain, which is sometimes not even possible, or not even not even a, I'm trying to say it's automatic. It's not something that a person plans to do. When a person suffers, you sometimes cry out in pain, even though you don't mean to. It's not your intention, but it's a natural thing. And that's the perhaps the idea of this kina oya and oya oya mehalanu. So many beautiful things which were destroyed, including the Beis Hamikdash and various different kalim. We've had that theme before. Just I think the notion of oya and oya mehalanu is almost like a cry that it's involuntary. That's what I was looking for. And the same thing is true in the following kina. Even though the following kina is not about the Churban HaBayis, but the following kina will say them back to back as the hour is getting late. But Lamed Beis and Lamed Gimel. The kina of Lamed Gimel, Eva La Orer, also, it's parallel in the sense that it ends with that the double called a groan, Oyoli, Alalai Li, woe unto me. Again, the second one of this pair of 33, Lamed Gimel, is about the Crusades. But again, sometimes you suffer, and just it's something which we can't even control. And so on Tisha B'Av, we're not supposed to try and control it. We're supposed to let our in our pain and our suffering and our frustration, we're supposed to let it out. We're supposed to cry. And Ovel's supposed to cry. A lot of times people think, you know, you go to a Beis Ovel, Rachon Litzan, you're supposed to try and convince the person not to feel so bad and not to cry. No, that's not what it is. Okay, you're supposed to let the person cry. You're supposed to let the person express the emotion. And that's what these next two kinnas, so we'll say them back to back. Again, the first one talking about plundering Yerushalayim, the beauty of the Kalim and selling Yerushalayim. The second one, a fourth kinnah about the crusade. In fact, it's interesting in the kinnah of Lamed Gimel, I'll just point out, in the Zion stanza, it says, Mein Shas Tatnu. It tells you the year. Okay, it tells you the year from the time of Bris Olam. And it gives you the exact date, which was the year... 1096 in the on the secular calendar. So it's telling you exactly when it took place. Okay, so we'll say these two kinnas back to back, Lamed Beis and the Lamed Gimel. The next kinna Lamed Dalad, is the kinna which was also composed regarding a specific event that took place, according to Chazal, at the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and that is the event of Nebuzradan coming in to the Beis HaMikdash, finding blood bubbling on the ground. It was the blood of a Navi, that the Jew, a Kohen, a Navi that the Jews themselves had killed, a Navi Zechariah, not the Zechariah of Zechariah ben Berechiah, the Zechariah of Treyaser Zechariah, but an earlier Zechariah, Zechariah ben Yehoyada, who was a Kohen, and he protested when they brought in a Tzelem into the Beis HaMikdash, and he was put to death. And Nebuzradan came, by the way, according to Chazal, there was seven Averas done at that one moment, because he was an innocent person, he was a Kohen, he was a Navi, he was also a Shofet, and it happened on Yom Kippur, and it was in the Beis HaMikdash, and it was also Shabbos. So, a terrible thing. So, by miracle, the blood of Zechariah the Navi continued to bubble. Nebuzradan, the Babylonian general, Churban Bayis Rishon, who came in, who destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash under the auspices of Nebuchadnezzar, he saw the blood and he started to slaughter animals to pour it on top and see if the blood would stop bubbling. It didn't. And then he slaughtered many, many thousands and thousands of people, pouring that blood over this blood until it would eventually stop. It was basically sort of like a machlokas, so to speak, between the Nebuzradan and the blood. Nebuzradan wanted to silence the blood, and the blood continued to seethe and to boil and so on. And after he killed animals, he executed Kohanim, young and old, members of the Sanhedrin. And finally, Nebuzradan, after killing a huge amount of people, slaughtering so many people, cried out to God, and he said, "What else am I supposed to do? If you stop the blood from bubbling, I'll stop killing." And that's the Gemara that's in Gittin Daf Nun Zayin Amud Beis. And strangely, the Gemara says, and after that, Nebuzradan converted. He left his position as a general in the army of Nebuchadnezzar, and he converted. to Judaism. A very, very strange story, a very strange ending to a tragedy. Here we focus on the tragedy. Every phrase ends, every stanza ends with a pasuk from Megillas Eichon, the second paragraph. Yer v'bas Yehuda taniyah v'aniyah increased amongst the daughter of Yehuda, the Jewish people, moaning and mourning and so on. But ultimately, this individual did tshuva. Soloveitchik spoke about this for a long time. We won't go into it now. But why that even the person who is sunk to the lowest levels possible can possibly do tshuva. And that is a theme of Tisha B'Av as well. We already alluded to it earlier, that even a person thinks he's completely far gone, nonetheless, a person can come back. So this kina is actually composed by Yehuda Alevi. The verse is spelled acrostic, Yehuda Alevi. And we'll continue now with kina Lamed Dalad. The next kina, Shchuras Melo Miyayin, is the last of the kinas before the so-called Sion kinos, and basically sums up the Churban very briefly and the Mesiras Nefesh that the Kohanim presented. It says Val Mishmar Osam Omdu Velo Ozru Hamaleches Ad Asher Shupach Domo Kimeim Hamapeches. Right, until they were killed, they didn't give up their posts, and ultimately, it concludes with a request that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should allow us to take revenge on our enemies. And this is the last of the kinnas before the Tzion kinnas. We'll continue now. Kinnah Lamed Dalad. I'm sorry, Lamed Hey Shkur Zolom Yayin. Lamed Hey Shkur Zolom Yayin. Now come to the last collection of kinnos. The kinnah, starting with kinnah Lamed Vav, with the so-called Tzion kinnos, which will, again, the hour is late and our time is tight today. We won't pause in each one. We'll say the next. Well, Lamed Vav, Tzion, Shashala, we said already in Shul. So we'll say Lamed Zayin, Lamed Ches, Lamed Tes, and Mem, four kinnos consecutively. I'll speak again before Mem Aleph, which is Shali Sufa Ba'esh. But basically, the theme of the Tzion kinnos is the notion that we remember Nal Yerushalayim for the destruction, but for the beauty that it once was. And we pointed out in the past that there are really two things that we do. We have certain times where we engage in Zeichel LeChorban, other times we engage in Zeichel LeMikdash. And they're not identical. Zeichel LeChorban, we try to remember the tragedies, and we refrain from certain things. We don't paint the whole house. We don't have a full simcha, you know, like we break a glass at a wedding. We minimize the simcha. That's Zeichel LeChorban. But sometimes we do things that are Zeichel LeMikdash to remember the positives, to redo or replicate what was done in the Mikdash. So, for example, we take the lulav all week of Sukkot, even though the Torah only requires it outside of Yerushalayim, outside the Beis HaMikdash on the first day. We take it the whole week because that's what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. Or Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel, the Pesach Seder. We eat what Hillel ate in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. So there's a difference. And learn from different psukim, different makaras. Of Soloveitchik stressed this, that sometimes we have to remember Meshkachei Yerushalayim. So we remember Yerushalayim by refraining from certain things. Zeichel HaChorban. But it's also important, Zeichel HaMikdash, to replicate and try and recreate the beauty of what once was. And that's what these last series of kinos, starting with Tzion HaShashalai, we said already in Shul. But we'll say some of the others now, and we'll speak. I'll speak again just for a moment before Mem Aleph, and then we'll finish up the end of the kinnos. Kinnah Mem Aleph, sort of stuck in the middle of the Tzion kinnos. The Shali Sufa Be'esh was the kinnah composed by the Maram Rutenberg upon witnessing the burning of the 24 wagon loads of copies of the Talmud in 1242, Friday, Erev Shabbos, Parshas Chukas, and Maron Guru was a young man, was a witness, as a young man, was an eyewitness to this, and basically this hammers home the point that the destruction of Tzion, destruction of Yerushalayim, was not just a destruction of the nation, the Jewish people as a nation, but also the goal of our enemies was always to destroy our religious works and destroy our religion, and Ram Rutenberg, poignantly asked, Hayesh Torah Chadosha, as a Kadosh Baruch Hu rejected us. That's what the Christians claim, right? There's a new Torah called the New Testament, right? That's what he says, Hayesh Torah Chadosha. I have to ask that. And of course, that's not the case. But nevertheless, that's a kina on this terrible event. And so we'll say that kina now, followed by the last two Tzion kinos, that's Membeis and Membeis and Mem Gimel. After which we will say another kina in commemoration of the last week at Tzion Kinas Mem Gimel Mem Dalet, and then we'll join together again for the kinna for the martyrs of the Holocaust, the victims of the Holocaust. This one written by Rav Schwab, the one by the Baba Reb we said earlier in Shul, and then we'll conclude with Eli Tzion. So again, we'll continue now with kinna Mem Aleph Shali Sufa Beish, followed by the last three Tzion kinos. We'll continue now with the kina composed by Rav Schwab Zichron Levracha from the Kadash Yeshurun Broyers Kehilla. It's on page 386, at least in my edition, and maybe a couple pages off in yours. But you can look there for the one from the Baba Reb we said already this morning. So we'll say the other one now. The second of the two kinas printed in commemoration of the lives lost in the Shoah. We already explained a few times how we observe on Tisha B'Av Avelos for all kinds of tragedies, whether they happened on the 9th of Av on that particular date or not. And this is an example, asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to remember the tragedy of the Holocaust, again, which is close to home still for many of us today. Even though every year, obviously, there are less and less survivors left, nonetheless, it's something which we can relate to, you know, certainly in the lifetime, if not our own lifetime, the lifetime of parents and the grandparents. Who experience it. So the kinna written by Schwab, and that'll be followed by Eli Tzion and the conclusion of kinnas. We'll conclude now with Eli Tzion, the last of the kinnos. So we stand up, we sing in the traditional tune. Eli Tzion, we wail Tzion like a woman who is suffering from the pains of childbirth. And it's the hope that just as the woman who cries and weeps moans in the pain of childbirth ultimately has, Baruch Hashem, a healthy child to show for it. Hopefully all of our crying and weeping and groaning and recitation of kinnos will ultimately result as well in our seeing, like I said at the outset, Zoche V'ro, we keep the Yerushalayim, Beis HaMikdash, everything represents alive. And so we'll be Zoche V'ro with the Nechamas Tzion. We'll witness that B'mehir of Yameinu. We'll conclude now with Eli Tzion.
Litzion the Oreo, oh, we show the Tweed, the
Something to be
Todor, recall Zimro.